Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kasa Sadama. There he addressed the monks. "Monks, venerable sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this: monks, this is a direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. What are the four? Here, monks, a monk abides." Now, the word that they have here is contemplating, and I don't use the word contemplating because that means thinking about. So I changed that to observing. A monk abides observing the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides observing feeling as feeling, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides observing mind as mind, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides observing mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Now we're going to do the observation of the body. And the first part is the mindfulness of breathing. Now this is a very misunderstood section of this particular sutta. Almost everyone does mindfulness of breathing in a way that causes mind to have one-pointed concentration. And when you're told how to do the practice, you put your attention on your nose or your abdomen, and you notice the in and out breath. You focus on the in and out breath. That's the way you're taught. But that doesn't follow the directions that are given in this sutta. And how, monks, does a mind abide observing the body as a body? Here a monk gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or an empty hut sits down. Now this says having folded his legs crosswise. During the time of the Buddha, everybody sat on the floor except the kings and all of these kind of people. And as a result, they got very used to sitting on the ground. And these days, we don't sit on the floor so much anymore. And because of that, our hips are actually different now than they were back then, because when they were sitting on the floor, they had to sit with their legs crossed, and their hips started turning a little bit. Now they're turning back. That's why it's so painful to sit on the floor for a half an hour or 45 minutes. That's why I don't insist that you sit on the floor. You're used to sitting in the chairs all the time, so sit in a chair. There's no magic in the floor. Sitting on the floor, there's a lot of pain that arises because of that, especially when you're not used to it. I had a lady that wanted to do a retreat with me. she was very, she followed the precepts very, very closely her whole life. She didn't know anything about meditation, so she wanted to do a retreat. So I gave her the instructions, and after the morning, right after lunch, I went to her and said, "How's your meditation going?" And she said, "Well, you know, I can only sit for about 45 minutes. Only. That's the key word. Well, why don't you sit longer?" "Because I'm not used to sitting on the floor. There's a lot of pain, and that's as long as I can stand it." So I told her, "There's no magic in the floor. Sit in a chair." She sat in a chair. She didn't have pain come up, and she sat for 4 hours, which was rather shocking to me, because that's a long time to sit, especially for the first time you've ever done a retreat. She had gotten into the first jhana the first day of the retreat. So don't be attached to sitting on the floor. It's much easier to sit in chairs. I want you to sit comfortably. Learning how to sit on the floor, sometimes you have to adjust the height of sitting on pillows. Now, when I went to Burma, that was in 1988, I brought a meditation cushion with me. Now, they're used to sitting flat on the floor in Burma because that's the way they're raised. They sit on the floor. And I saw some monks come up when I wasn't around, but I just walked in and saw them do it. They started kicking my pillow like it was stupid. "Get that away from here." So, sit comfortably. And I had to do a lot of adjusting with different kinds of pillows so that I could get the right height so that my legs didn't go to sleep. If I went flat on the floor, my legs go to sleep. That's just the way it worked. And we were supposed to be sitting for an hour and then walking for an hour. And it was torture sitting for a whole hour. Now, they are very much interested in having pain arise. And they say, "Well, all life is suffering, so this is just a little bit of suffering. Sit on the floor." Well, my legs, I never sat on the floor at home. I always sat on the couch or sat in a chair. So I had to get other pillows so that I could find the right height so that my legs didn't go to sleep. And sometimes you have to put a pillow under one of your legs because flat on the floor it goes to sleep. If you raise it a little bit, then your leg wouldn't go to sleep. But it took a while to adjust. And the Burmese just thought that that was the most ridiculous thing going. But I wasn't about to cause myself undue suffering. After I left Burma, I was there for 8 months, and that was when the Burmese had their civil war, and the army was shooting people and that sort of thing. And it got near the end of the rains retreat, and the Burmese government said all foreign monks have to leave the country. And we still had a week left to go for our Range retreat. So they went and talked to the government, so we stayed an extra week. And they said, okay, tomorrow you have to leave. Fine, but there wasn't any airplanes. And they got downright mad because we couldn't leave. The only way to get into Burma was by air. So we had to spend an extra day there. Anyway, I was pretty used to sitting on the floor as long as the pillows were right. And I was able to sit for fairly long periods of time sitting on the floor. So we got kicked out of the country. I went to Thailand, and then I went to Malaysia, and I did a six-month loving-kindness retreat. And it took me a little over a year to get a visa to get back into the country. And I had to have the head of the monastery with his paperwork, and I had to do a lot of paperwork. It was really nonsense stuff, because they would only let a foreigner stay in the country for 1 week. But I wound up staying there for 2 years. Now, when I went to a different monastery to do the practice, I learned very well that when I was at Mahasi Center, they don't have many people that understand English. So we had to have interpreters that you go in for an interview, you talk to the interpreter, you tell them exactly what's happening in your meditation. And it'd take a couple of minutes, and then the interpreter would turn to the teacher and he'd say about 5 words. And then the teacher would come back and he'd give a long explanation. And he'd turn to us and he'd say, you have to try harder. What kind of instruction is that? So I found another monastery where the teacher actually spoke English. Now, when I went in for the first day of the retreat, then I went to the interview with him. He said, how long do you sit? He said, I sit for an hour and walk for an hour. That was just standard practice at that time. Good. Why don't you sit longer? Yeah, okay, I can do that. I came in the next day. He said, how long did you sit? I sat for 2 hours, walked for an hour. Good. Why don't you sit longer? Okay. I can do it, but it's not going to be a nice thing. I came in the next day. How long did you sit? I sat for 3 hours, and I walked for an hour, and it was quite painful. Good. Why don't you sit longer? Oh, man. So I said, okay, I'll give it a try. I used the try word. I came in the next day, and I'd gone through an exceptional amount of pain with that sitting. He said, how long did you sit? Sat for 4 hours, walked for an hour. Did you move? Well, yeah, I moved a lot. There's a lot of pain. You can't move. Oh, man. So I come in the next day and I have tears coming down my face. I wasn't crying. It was just so painful. It's like hitting your head real hard and you get tears from it. And he said, how long did you sit? I said, I sat for 4 hours, walked for an hour. Why don't you sit longer? Oh, no, he said, did you move? And I said, no, and I never want to do that again. And he said, why don't you sit longer? And I said, no. Now, I'm the kind of person that follows directions pretty closely. But it was just such a painful experience. It was just unbelievable. He kept after me. Now, this is 4 days into the retreat. And I'm sitting with 2 hours of extreme pain in my knees, in my back. And he wanted me to sit longer. No, I'm not going to do that. But he kept after me. After 4 or 5 days, he said, why don't you try sitting a little longer? And eventually I got it worked up so that I could sit for between 6 and 8 hours. The walking meditation that I had us do, you know, I'm having you walk normal pace or even faster so that you get exercise. When we were walking, we walked super slow. And lifting. And I could see about 500 different movements in just raising my foot and then moving. And from that wall to that wall, it took me about 45 minutes to go one direction. So I got almost no exercise. I was there for 2 years. I don't know if you notice, I have a little trouble walking because I got blood clots, because I didn't have enough exercise, getting the blood moving. And that was, when I left Burma, it was 1992. I went there in 1990. And I've had problem with my legs ever since. But I followed his directions. It was pushing. It was trying too hard. Now, a nice thing that happened when I started sitting longer, when I get up into an 8 hour sit, the first 2 hours, 2.5 hours, okay. The next 2 hours, a lot of pain. Then the pain went away, and I could sit very peacefully and calm. Up to about 7 hours, and then the pain came back, so I would sit with another hour of pain, and I was like, that's enough, I don't want to do this anymore. So the reason that I have you walking is for your exercise. The interesting thing is, Mahasi Sayadaw, who's the guy that came up with this particular method of meditation and made it popular, never walked slowly. He walked back and forth. They made a hallway for him up one floor, and there was no windows in it, so you couldn't see what he was doing, but he was walking pretty fast most of the time, getting his exercise. But now you go to a Vipassana center and everybody's walking very slowly and they're talking about walking mindfully. And one of the things that happened when I was walking so slowly was I was getting massive headaches, tightness in my head. And I'd go to the teacher and I say, I really have a lot of tightness in my head. And the pain can get so intense that it was like taking a red-hot needle and just sticking it in my brain. That's how intense it was. And you know what his instructions were? Oh, it'll go away by itself after a while. Don't worry about it. Now, isn't that interesting? You're supposed to be improving your mindfulness and calming down, but having, because of the force of the one-pointed concentration, not letting go of that craving, it causes a tightness in your head, in your mind, and it does become a big distraction. So this is some of the reasons I'm teaching you the way I'm teaching you. I don't want you to have a lot of pain. Yeah. You want to watch what's happening with mind. You move. Are you watching your mind? No. You can move as much as he does. You want to watch mind's movement, how mind's attention moves. Yeah.
It seems so clear in the suttas that self-mortification is the exact opposite of the Buddha's path.
It does seem that way, doesn't it? Well, what happened with Vipassana, the way it got started, was a book called the Visuddhimagga. And the Visuddhimagga, what it does is it takes one-pointed concentration on this section of the book, and then Vipassana, or insight in another part of the book. So it divides the collected mind with and making a different meditation with Vipassana. Mahasi Sayadaw took that book and he made a sub-commentary. And in the sub-commentary, he writes the instructions of how to do the way Vipassana is taught right now. And the way that he wrote it, he said, when you get to this section and you have this insight, this is going to happen. And it did. So everybody got real excited. This is a way that really works, and you can see that. It's too bad that he didn't spend the time looking at the suttas themselves and seeing what the instructions actually were. And that's what I'm going to show you right now. These instructions are very plain. But what he was teaching was one-pointed concentration. If you go to people that are practicing meditation other than this, and you talk to them about the tension and tightness in your head, they won't even recognize that it's there. It has to be intentionally relaxed. And when you talk about craving, their idea of craving, oh, it's just desire. And the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering, don't desire anything. Now that's ridiculous. There's still preferences that even the Buddha had, going here and going there and doing different things. So it's misunderstood. But because of the way that Mahasi Sayadaw wrote the sub-commentary and people started doing it and seeing that what he said in his sub-commentary did happen that way, they gained a lot of confidence. And then it just started growing after that. There's 300 Vipassana Mahasi Sayadaw Vipassana centers in Burma. So there's the whole population really believes in this stuff. And then Americans started finding out about it, and they sent some of the Burmese teachers to Sri Lanka, and they started teaching Vipassana this way. And then it became popular in Burma, or in Sri Lanka, excuse me. And a lot of people were going from the West to Sri Lanka, and they ran across that kind of meditation. They came back, and then they started teaching it here. One of the first Westerners went to India, where there was a teacher by the name of Munindra. He was a little Bangladesh monk. And it was Joseph Goldstein that went there, and he practiced with Munindra for a couple of years in India. Then he met Jack Kornfield, who became a monk and was in Thailand. And they hooked up together and decided to co-teach. And they went to Boulder, Colorado, when, what was his name, Trumpa? Yeah, when Trumpa was there. And they had a big gathering of people. It's like a conference. And Jack and Joseph were teaching this form of meditation. And it was a lot different from what the Tibetans and the Mahayanas were teaching. And a lot of people said, okay, this is it. It's like these were the two guys that actually knew more about meditation than these other traditions. And they became very popular, and eventually they have a place on the East Coast and on the West Coast now. But basically, the same teaching in Vipassana is being taught at these places. And it is a one-pointed concentration. They give it all kinds of different handles, and they call it moment-to-moment awareness, and they call it choiceless awareness, and they give it all different kinds of names, but they don't have the relaxed step in any of that. As a result, the practice that they're doing doesn't match up with the suttas very well. Now, I had 20 years of doing this practice. I went to the end of it. I know what all the insight knowledges are. And I was rather disappointed with the end result after 2 years of doing a retreat. And I left Burma and I went to Malaysia. And the people that sponsored me to go to Burma and then come back, they were real excited because I'd done that much meditation. And some of the meditation that I was doing, I was at the center, at Mahasi Center, when I went the first time. You went to bed at 11 o'clock, you got up at 3 o'clock. You walked for an hour, you sat for an hour. You had, at the right time, you had breakfast. You go back, you walk for an hour and sit for an hour, you eat lunch. And then you walk for an hour and sit for an hour until 11 o'clock at night. So that's only 4 hours sleep. So that's what I was doing. I was following that. And I walked into the teacher one day, and he said, "How much sleep are you taking?" And I said, 4 hours. That's what you tell me to do here. He said, why are you being so lazy? Why are you sleeping so much? So I said, fine. I got it down to 2 hours. I did that for 3 months. 2 hours sleep a day, that's what I had. I don't recommend it. I mean, the way that I'm teaching right now is such a walk in the park, it's unbelievable. I mean, I'm giving you 8 hours sleep if you want to take it. Go to bed at 10 o'clock, get up at 5. 7 hours right there. After lunch, you have another hour. You can lay down and take a rest. 8 hours sleep. I was taking 2. Now, when I left Burma, I went back to Malaysia, and I wound up sleeping for about 6 weeks because I was so exhausted. I'd get up in the morning, I'd go out on alms round, I would eat, then I would lay down and take rest, and I would sleep until the afternoon, 3 or 4 o'clock, get up and walk around a little bit, go back to bed. It took about 6 weeks to overcome that 3 months of wrong practice. And I didn't really gain that much good attention. I was sitting 16 hours a day, sitting and walking. And I figured that that was okay. I did that, found it didn't work. I'm not going to do that anymore. So the second time I went to Burma, I went to a different teacher. And the first day I was there, I said, Bhante, how much sleep should we take? He said, 6 hours. 6 hours? Man, this is a walk in the park. All right. And I wound up staying there for 2 years doing a retreat. I didn't try sitting that long except when he was pushing me, but eventually after I sat for 6 or 8 hours a day and that lasted about a month. Then I started backing off. And I was sitting for 2 hours, 3 hours. It wasn't so bad. It was pretty easy. And I had an interpreter that actually understood what I said, which is that I like talking to English-speaking monks. Anyway, when I got back to Malaysia after that period of time, people there got real excited because I had done so much meditation. They said, please teach us. But I couldn't teach Vipassana. I just didn't have confidence in it. So this group of people, it was called the Buddhist Graduate Fellowship. They were going to have a weekend retreat. And they wanted me to teach the weekend retreat. I said, the only thing I'm going to teach you is loving kindness meditation. And they said, fine. So I started teaching them loving kindness meditation, and they took to it. And there was about 60 people. And I was seeing everybody every day and doing what I do here. And they really started to like that. And because of that, I was the first person in Malaysia that wasn't teaching mindfulness of breathing. And I became somewhat popular. And every month I was giving a retreat 2 times a month for a week. After a period of time, the head monk at the Sri Lankan temple in Kuala Lumpur, very famous monk, he'd written 60 or 70 books, and he was dearly loved by everybody, but he didn't know anything about meditation. So he asked me to come to Kuala Lumpur. I was in Penang at the time, which is about a 6-hour drive away. And every Friday night, he gave a Dhamma talk. And he said, you know, I'm getting old now. I want you to come here, and every other Friday, I want you to give a Dhamma talk. And there was between 300 and 500 people that came to these Dhamma talks. So I said, okay, I'll do it. As long as I can teach meditation too, not just give a Dhamma talk. Fine. So it was getting close to the rains retreat, where monks have to stay in one place for 3 months. And there is a ceremony that we go through at the start of the rains retreat. And the way monks do things is by seniority. Now, I've been a monk for about 6 years. And there's other monks that had been monks for 12 years, 15 years, 20 years. But when it got time for the ceremony, the chief monk said, you come and sit beside me. And all of these other senior monks are there, and I'm not feeling very comfortable about that. And he starts giving his talk, and there's like, it must have been 1,500 people. And he starts saying, we are really blessed to have this very famous monk stay with us for the rains retreat. So I started looking down the aisle, wondering which monk it was. And he said, I'm going to have him give you a talk right now. And I'm still looking down, wondering who it was, and I looked over, and he's handing me the microphone. And very quietly he said, just give an hour and a half talk. I wasn't prepared for that. And then he started saying that I was going to give a talk every other Friday night. So I got through it, and I was staying there, and they asked me to give meditation classes in different places in the monastery, and then I was getting invited out to give meditation teaching to other groups of people. So I was on the move every night. And when I gave a talk on the Friday night, I'd just gotten this book. Bhikkhu Bodhi just published it. Somebody gave me a copy of it. So I started reading the suttas. And they really liked that. And I found out later that as I was giving a talk with the microphone was hooked up to the chief monk's room so he could listen to my Dhamma talks. And then I would start teaching classes, and I had to use a loudspeaker, and it was in a big room, but there was, 30 people, 40 people. It was not any big deal. And as soon as I got done with the talk, I was walking outside, and he was standing outside the door. And I thought, that was unusual. And the next time I gave a talk, he came in and sat down, and he was listening to the instructions, and he started practicing the meditation without telling me I was teaching him. And he did pretty well on his own. He did, really did. But it was a shock to me to find out I was famous. What does that mean? Anyway, I stayed there for about 3 years. And then after that, that's when I decided to come back to the States. And I was used to large crowds. I was used to giving two-hour Dhamma talks. So I started giving retreats, and I'm giving two-hour Dhamma talks. And people are complaining over anything over 15 minutes.
Did this happen after you went into isolation, when you figured out, when you went and studied?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's when I went to, right after this book came out. I told the head monk, after having this book and finding out what gems I was finding, and having another monk come from Sri Lanka who wanted to know how I was teaching. So I told him. And he stopped me and he said, "You're teaching it just right, but you're using the language of the Visuddhimagga. Why don't you just put that on the shelf and let it be? And use the sutta language." So that's when I started reading the suttas. And I did it for a retreat for 40 or 50 people. And I started talking to them individually, and I'm finding out that they're starting to progress in the meditation really fast. Now, always before, because of the Visuddhimagga, it took you some years to get into a jhana. When I was in Thailand, the Thai monks said, "If you want to get into the jhana, it's going to take you 15 years. And I talked to some Sri Lankan monks that had come to Thailand, and they said, "Oh, you have to come to Sri Lanka. It only takes 10 years to get into a jhana." And after I started reading this stuff, well, let me finish with what Poonaji had told me. When I started doing that, I started understanding what it said in the suttas. Now, for 20 years, I'm using this other book. I knew this other book. I knew what it said. And when I got told to put it down, weird things started happening. Always before, when I didn't know something, I would go to this commentary, and then I would try to go to the suttas, and I never understood what the suttas were saying. It didn't agree with what I was saying here. So I always went back to that. But when I got a copy of this, and Poonaji said, "Put that book down, just do this," I understood everything I was reading. I mean, it was amazing. There's these light bulbs popping in my head. Oh, that's what that means. Yeah, it says it right here. See? So I told the head monk that I wanted to go to Thailand. I knew where there was a great cave. And I took the book with me, and I told him I'd be back in 2 weeks. Now, what I did was I would get up in the morning, I would go out on alms round, I would eat my food, and the rest of the morning I would spend reading the suttas. I'd take some rest in the afternoon, and after that I would start sitting. And I would sit from 1 o'clock roughly till 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And I did this every day for 2 weeks, and I was learning so much and finding out what the Buddha actually said that I couldn't stop. So after 3 months, the head monk sent somebody from the temple to come get me. So I had to stop doing it. But when I started reading the suttas to people, they had been around Buddhism for a long time, but it wasn't very clear ever. And when I started reading what the Buddha said, in 2 or 3 days, people were getting into the jhanas. Now, this is really remarkable because other monks are telling me it's 10 or 15 years, and I come back to them and I say, no, it's only 2 or 3 days. Oh, I don't believe you. Come and do a retreat, you'll see. And I have dyslexia. That's why you see me use a book marker. Because when I read, words get all screwed up. And I wanted to get rid of the dyslexia as much as I could. Then that's why I started reading the suttas to everybody and reading out loud. And then explaining a bit about what I thought the Buddha was saying. The progress in the meditation was phenomenal. Lots and lots of people were really gaining advantage and getting into the fourth jhana and starting to get into the arupa jhanas. And then the vipassana people started coming to me, and they did not like it. They didn't like that I was not following what everybody else followed. But I said, okay, invite me to your temple, and I'm going to read you a sutta and see what you think. So I did that, and they never invited me back. And to this day, there's a lot of people that they think what I'm teaching is nonsense, and they don't want to listen to the Dhamma. They don't want to listen to what it says in this. Now, this particular sutta is the Satipatthana Sutta. That's the sutta that people practicing straight vipassana use as their holy grail, as it were. But I'm going to read this tonight, hopefully, maybe some tomorrow. But it's not talking about vipassana, it's talking about jhana practice. So all these people that are saying, well, in the Satipatthana Sutta it says this, it doesn't. It doesn't say that. It's talking about jhana practice. Now, my first real bona fide teacher, I could say, was a very famous monk from Burma. His name was Usilananda, Sayadaw Usilananda. And when he first came to this country, I went to him and I asked him if I could be his attendant and live in the monastery and take care of him and offer him food, take him wherever he wanted to go, do whatever he wanted to do, but he had to teach me. So I had this brilliant monk. Now, why I call him brilliant? Before he was 28 years old, he had memorized this many books. And he took a test on this. And the way the test goes is, okay, this is a Satipatthana Sutta. It's going to be mindfulness of breathing. Okay, here a monk gone to the forest to the root of the hut, or an empty hut, sits down and sets his mind, his body erect and establishes mindfulness in front of him. Continue. Now, if you miss six times, you failed the test. Okay? He didn't miss anything. And there was a very comprehensive written part of the test. In that year, he was the number one monk in the country for not having made a mistake. So he really knew a lot about Buddhism. And I'm just a dumb American. I don't know anything about it. I was, at the time, I was a layman. So I had this monk available to me anytime I wanted to ask a question. And I would ask him, 20, 25 questions a day. And I did it for 2 years. And he said, you know, in the suttas, it says that if you ask questions, you're going to be super intelligent when you are reborn in the next lifetime as a human being. And you're going to be smarter than Einstein, because I ask him so many questions. That's why it's disappointing not to have you ask questions. Because you hurt yourself by not finding out. So, when I came back to this country and I was giving 2 and 3 hours talks, people didn't really like that so much. And there was a lot of complaining about it. But there's a lot to be said. There's a lot to be understood. And most people in this country, they don't know any much about Buddhism. So that's why the talks are long. But over the years, I've been cutting down a little bit. I don't generally give 3-hour talks anymore. But I give 1.5 hour and 2-hour talks. Anyway. Yeah.
What is the single most exquisite thing you have learned from the Buddhist teachings in all of that pain, in all of that searching?
That I don't have to do it. I don't have to put up with that kind of pain. That's why I want you to sit comfortably. Having pain come up in your body because you're sitting on the floor and you're not used to it is not useful to your meditation. But what they tell you in Vipassana, you have a pain in your knee. Put your attention right in the middle of that pain and see its true nature. And note it, pain, 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 until it goes away. You know what happens when you put your attention on something like that? It gets bigger and more intense. So you're causing yourself even more pain by following that kind of direction. What do I tell you to do with the pain? Let it be there by itself. Relax. Don't keep your attention on it. That's what right effort is in the Eightfold Path. The 6 R's are another way of describing right effort. And right effort will take you all the way to arahatship.
So much of mainstream teachings today emphasizes noting.
Yeah, I know.
And it's my estimate that it just holds you into a place for too long. Yeah. Verbal. Am I correct in observing that?
Absolutely. And you don't let whatever that pain happens to be go. And you wind up having to fight with the hindrances. Oh, restlessness. Let's suppress it. Let's make it stop. Let's make it go away. Push it away. No, what do I tell you to do with restlessness? Push it away? No, I tell you to 6R. I have a friend that's been teaching meditation, Vipassana meditation, for 50 years. When he first started doing the meditation, he had real fear of getting in front of people and talking. I saw him last year on a video, YouTube. He was in New York. He was giving a talk to about 2,000 people that were psychologists, psychiatrists, a psychotherapist, and listening to him give the talk, I could hear fear in his voice. Now, 50 years of noting didn't make it go away. It doesn't bother him so much, but it's still there. Why? Because he still has craving. And after he gave his talk, he started talking about his fear. He said, yeah, it still comes up, but it doesn't bother me as much. And this is somebody that's done a lot of meditation. But what kind of meditation has he been doing? One-pointed concentration. I've written to him. We've been friends since the 70s. And I've suggested to him that he try using a relaxed step. He wrote back and he said, we're really eclectic. We use some from this teaching and some from that teaching, and we kind of mix all of our teaching together. I don't want to stop doing that. Okay, fine. Keep your fear. Keep your hindrances. The biggest problem with straight Vipassana is you can do it for a while and you can gain some degree of calm mind. But after doing it for a few years and taking 1 month, 3 month retreats, what happens is you'll get to a place where you hit a wall and you just don't go any further. Now, I was listening to one Vipassana teacher and the student, tears in her eyes. She said, when are we going beyond this? I've hit this spot. And the teacher's answer, you have to grin and bear it. Wait a minute. Is that the Buddha's teaching? Doesn't seem to be that to me. And this is very popular teachers that have this idea. They're real attached and they don't want to change. What can I do about that? Not a thing. Yeah, I know what I can do about it. Teach you guys and you go out and tell them. Yeah.
It's been a new trend to go. A lot of these popular teachers are now going to the suttas, and they're not interpreting them properly.
Yes, I understand.
I don't really know, you know, very much. I just know from studying you that, you know, they're doing that wrong, and it's kind of sad.
Yeah. But we have, what was it you said, David? 700,000 hits on our YouTube?
So people are watching the videos. I'm sending questions and inquiries. And fear comes from aversion.
Yeah.
Like the hatred part of craving.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you become an anagami, you lose fear.
Fear. No more fear. No more aversion. A mind that's, it has loving kindness, it has strong mindfulness, it has a collected mind. Not a lot of disturbance in the mind. It's worth it. Anybody else? Yeah.
What year did you go into seclusion?
Which time?
The retreat where you spent 3 months in the cave.
1995. And that was, oh boy, I wish I could have done it for a year. It was really an amazing time. I was learning so much and understanding it and having these light bulbs going off so much of the time. It got real exciting. I can't wait till I get back and show everybody. And then they're straight Vipassana people and I don't want to hear it. Oh, okay.
Was that the year you had a roommate, the cobra?
Yeah. Yeah, the cobra was in the cave. I lived with him for 3 months. We had a good relationship. He didn't bother me. Sometimes I'd throw him some food. And I put a little dish out for water. So no problem. It sounds really strange, though. Okay. Okay, breathing in long, he understands I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, he understands I breathe out short. Now, this is the first two sentences in the instructions. Did you hear me say nose or nostril or abdomen or focus only on the breath? No. Why? Because that's not in the instructions. And it doesn't even say focus on the breath. It doesn't tell you where to put your attention. It just said you understand when you take a long breath. You understand when you take a short breath. You understand when your breath is fast. You understand when it's slow. You understand when it's gross. You understand when it's subtle. You understand. It doesn't say focus only on this. And that's the way it's being taught these days. Now, the next two sentences are the actual instruction. And it starts out by saying, he trains thus. That's how you know it's the actual instruction. This is the nitty-gritty. This is what you got to do. I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. Now, an interesting thing. Your brain is like this. It has two lobes. And you have a bag that goes around each lobe. It's called the meninges. But that's not all there is with the meninges. The meninges also goes all the way down your spine. And it's a bag. And when there's movement in mind, it pushes against the meninges and it causes tightness. Now, what do you do with tightness? Relax. Okay? And you can do that all the way up and down the spine. Where there's tightness there, you can feel it. And you relax. Every thought, every feeling, every sensation that arises causes that tightness to arise. What is that? That's how you recognize craving. So these massive headaches I was getting by doing one-pointed concentration was actually because I didn't relax. Relax on the in-breath, relax on the out-breath. That's what it says to do. Now, the interesting part of this is something that is completely ignored by most people that are reading the sutta. It says, he trains thus. I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains thus. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. What does that mean? Now, I know people practicing one-pointed concentration, and they'll say, well, when I'm doing this meditation that I don't relax the tightness, my mind eventually becomes tranquil. But because of this little statement, he trains thus, in Pali it's called pasambaya. Pasambaya can be a verb, it can be a noun, it can be an adverb, it can be an adjective, depending on the other words around it. Pasambaya means to tranquilize. Okay, it's a verb. So it's not after you get to a certain state you're going to feel tranquil. It says to tranquilize on the in-breath and tranquilize on the out-breath. That's a lot different than the instructions in meditation right now. Now, one-pointed concentration. Your mind is on the breath, gets distracted. Let go of the distraction, come right back to your object of meditation. Come back to the breath. What are you doing when you do that? You're not letting go of the craving, you're bringing the craving back to your object of meditation.
My experience with that is it's trying to control with control.
Absolutely.
And it starts a feedback loop.
That's, yeah.
And after about 10 days of that, I want to drink.
Yeah, you want to back off, right? Yeah, but I only did it for 2 years. I'm a slow learner. Now, when you're practicing this, your mind is on your object of meditation, say the breath, and your mind is distracted. You let go of the distraction. Then tranquilize. That's what it says to do right here. Tranquilize the bodily formation. What is it talking about? That tension and tightness is in your head, in your mind. So when you do that, when you relax and let go of that craving, which is the I like it, I don't like it mind, right after that, your mind is very clear. You don't have thoughts distracting you at all. Your mind is very bright. and your mind is pure. Why? Because you've let go of craving. So, now with right effort, it's four parts. The first part is you recognize that an unwholesome state arose. What's an unwholesome state? I am that. Something, it's a hindrance. The next part, it says to let go of the unwholesome state, and then you relax. The next part is to bring up a wholesome state. Smile. Why do we use that? Because it makes your mind very alert. It keeps your mind light. Then you bring that wholesome, light mind back to your object of meditation. Return to your object of meditation. Stay with your object of meditation as long as you can. It's right effort. Now, when people are practicing straight vipassana, what are they doing? They say, the pain comes, put your attention right in the middle of it, and note it until it goes away. And then immediately come back to your primary object of meditation, which is the breath. So you're bringing the craving back to that. That's why it's one-pointed concentration. Now, a lot of people will have a lot of advantage doing one-pointed concentration. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying that the one-pointed concentration doesn't have the same end result that I'm interested in. People that are teaching one-pointed concentration, they'll start telling you that your mind gets into a state of bliss. You don't have any hindrances coming up. The force of the concentration stops hindrances from coming up. Hindrances are important. That's where your attachments are. So, if you don't have a relaxed step in your meditation, the end result can be very nice. A lot of people get into beautiful states of mind where they're really peaceful for a long period of time. They don't have any disturbances. Now, I had a student in Australia. He'd been practicing one-pointed concentration with one of the famous teachers in Australia. 7 years. He was very good at getting into this beautiful state of mind, but he said, he wrote to me on the email, and he said, you know, I've been doing this meditation for 7 years, and I don't see any personality change. I still get angry. I still have a lot of lust. I still have a lot of problems. And I don't seem to be purifying my mind like the Buddha was talking about. He said, will you teach me? And I said, of course. Okay. So I gave the instructions that I just read to you about mindfulness of breathing. But he'd been doing the mindfulness of breathing in a different way, and he kept forgetting to use the relaxed step, so he was just carrying on like he was. After a while, I said, this, you're not doing it right. We have to change this. I want you to do loving kindness meditation. So I gave him the instructions in that. And after a couple of days, he writes back and he said, I have so many distractions. I have so much stuff coming up. I'm going to go back to my breath because at least I have some peace and calm. And he kept complaining like that. And finally, I got tired of listening to it, quite frankly. So I said, okay, this is what I want you to do. I don't want you to sit in meditation for 1 week. All you have to do for this 1 week, I don't care what you're doing, smile. And when it's hard to smile, laugh. And then I didn't hear from him again. So I'm thinking, well, he's not getting it, so what can I do? A week later, he writes back, and he said, I really took it seriously what you said. And this is the advantages I saw in smiling. He said, I started smiling, and I'd walk one place or another, and I started noticing that my posture started changing. And instead of letting my mind ho-hum around, I just started smiling. And as my posture changed, I started smiling to people that I walk by. And you want to know something weird? They smiled back. And that's never happened to me. And he said, another thing that started happening is these strangers that I was smiling to, they would come up and start talking to me. And that never happened before. He said, even when it was difficult to smile, I smiled anyway. Now, since I've seen a psychology paper on smiling, and they said, even if it's a false smile, when you put a smile on your face, your mind starts looking down and says, I must be happy. So your mind becomes uplifted. And he said, I kept smiling and there was all this advantage. And I wrote back to him and I said, do you notice any difference in your mindfulness? He said, I've been practicing meditation for 7 years. I didn't even know what mindfulness was. Now I understand it. Then the thing that shocked me came. And he said, now I don't have to take so many drugs. And I said, drugs? Well, yes, I'm in a mental institute. And he started going through changes. They told him when he entered the mental institute, he was going to be there for the rest of his life. He was very severe bipolar. And after about 6 months of this practice, and he really started to understand loving kindness, and he started practicing it, and everything was just great. After about 6 months, they let him out. So what's the advantage of smiling all the time? Corners of your mouth. The University of Minnesota did a study on the corners of your mouth. When the corners of your mouth go down, so does your mental state. The corners of your mind or corners of your mouth go up, so does your mental state. He's done some pretty amazing things since he's been out of the mental institute, helping us transcribe tapes and all kinds of things. So with the relaxed step, he started really understanding more and more about how mind works. And it started changing his personality. So he was going through some major changes just by doing loving-kindness meditation with the relaxed step. And it's really, really important. There goes another half hour. Yeah.
In the fourth step there, in Siksara, this is the smile. This is, you bring up a wholesome state.
Right.
Could that be another awakening factor?
Smiling?
And a wholesome state.
Well, the awakening factor, mindfulness, investigation of your experience, energy, joy, tranquility, stillness or collectedness, equanimity. And I wanted to, at one time, I thought very seriously about 9 awakening factors. One is curiosity. And the second was persistence. And that's what it really takes. But as I started giving more talks to monks and that sort of thing, they decided it wasn't such a good idea. So I let it go. So when the awakening factors happen and they get in perfect balance, that's when Nibbana occurs. But you can't make it happen in a particular way. Sometimes when I'm giving retreat and somebody has a lot of restlessness, that's when I tell them to use the tranquility with their object of meditation. Sometimes I suggest to some people that they use stillness because of the restlessness. So I use the awakening factors sometimes just so that your mind can get it more in balance.
Doesn't equanimity kind of cover all of those in a way?
Yeah, it does. But it's a little bit more, the individual of doing it is a little bit stronger. But equanimity, that's the one.
So do you employ an awakening factor, or is it something that
I tell you to bring it up?
Occurs to you?
I tell you to use it, how to use it.
So you employ it, it's volitional.
It can be. But as you let go of craving more and more, your mind naturally starts to get in balance. The thing with this that I'm teaching you is a natural unfolding. You know, I don't tell you, now you got to get into the second jhana. I can explain to you what the second jhana is, but I can't get you to go there. You'll go from the first jhana to the second jhana when your mind is ready to do it. It'll go to the third jhana when it's ready to do it. And it can go all the way through like that. I had a Tibetan nun. And she started doing pretty well in her meditation. And she came angry at me one day. And she said, "You're pushing me too fast." And I said, "Really? I'm not pushing you to do anything. I'm explaining what your experience is. Your mind is going at the speed it wants to go at. It's not me doing anything. I'm just giving you some education. That's it." So the awakening factors will balance themselves by themselves. You'll notice you can be sitting for a little while and all of a sudden you get really peaceful, really calm. And that'll last for a little while and then something else happens. Well, that's your awakening factors starting to get into balance. And you're teaching yourself the whole meditation. I'm not your teacher. I'm a guide. My job is to keep you on the path. That's all. Some of the things I might suggest are real easy. Some of the things I might suggest, it can be difficult for a little while. But my intention for each and every one of you is to be happy. That's my job. Okay. Now, this part of the Satipatthana Sutta has always been really funny to me. I mean, it's just, I don't know why it even got in here. It's about the four postures. And it says again, when walking, a monk understands I am walking. When standing, he understands I am standing. When sitting, he understands I am sitting. When lying down, he understands I'm lying down. Do you know whether you're standing or not? Yes. Are you lying down now? I mean, this is really, and when I was doing straight Vipassana, they said when you get to the end of your walking, you have to note standing, like I didn't know I was standing. Or walking. Come on, give me a break.
It's basic mindfulness.
Is it?
I don't know. I mean, it sounds like I'm mindful that I'm sitting.
What does that mean? What's your definition of mindfulness?
Oh, no. Looking at what my mind is doing.
Not quite. Observing how mind's attention moves. This is a lot different than what you just said. But what you just said is what most people are giving to this is mindfulness. It's a very surface kind of definition that doesn't lead to seeing how mind actually works. I mean, it's just a surface thing. Okay, let's continue on. Now we go to full awareness. Again, a monk is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs, who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking and keeping silent. Full awareness of what?
What is not doing?
what mind is doing when you're doing these activities. Six R-ing, when your mind starts thinking about other stuff. Okay, then it gets into the body parts, and I'm not going to do that. Then it gets into the charnel ground observations, and I'm not going to get into that because there's very few places in the world where you can go to a charnel ground and watch bodies decay. Watch bodies decay. Charnel ground. In India, when somebody would die, they would cover them with white cloth, and they would take them to a place, and they would just leave them there. And then the family is supposed to come and take them and cremate and do all of these kind of things. Well, sometimes the family couldn't get there for 6 months. So you get a chance to go watch a body decay. And what happens with that. It's a real good lesson in attachment to your body. That's going to happen to me. My body's going to decay like that. It's either that or I'm going to get my body ground up and make dog food. I don't care. Well, what do I care what happens with this? It's not mine anyway, right?
You'll surprise you. Will it be premium dog food? Well, look what the Tibetans do with the vultures.
Yeah. It's too hard to dig in the ground there. They got too many rocks. Anyway. When I was teaching in Malaysia a lot, I had a lot of college students that were coming, and especially before their final exams. They'd come a couple weeks before and do a retreat so they could have a calm mind so that they could do well on their exam. Their exams, they only had one test a year. Either you passed or you failed. That's the way they were running it there. Now, all of these young people, 20, 21, 22 years old, their hormones are running all over the place. And they had real trouble with lust. So, what did I tell them to do? When a beautiful body walks by, in your mind, turn it inside out. How beautiful is it then? Oh, you've got a great set of intestines. Your liver is wonderful. That pus that you have in your body is really something. What does that do to your mind? Do you have lust in your mind now? No. So that's what I would tell them to do. Just turn the body inside out and start understanding that it's not you. It's just a bunch of things put together to make up a body. The smells of the body are sometimes truly amazing. I've been to autopsies. It's a real interesting process to watch somebody that morning just died, and there they are getting their organs cut out, and they cut the scalp, and then they just flip it over into the face, and they take a saw and open up the skull, pull out the brain. Ah, this person had a blood vessel pop in their brain. That's why they're dead. But while they're doing that, what was happening to me is where am I? Am I part of this body? Where am I? interesting question. And you start losing attachment to this. This particular kind of meditation, when it's done in a intense way, has to be done with a teacher, because you can become so repulsed by your body. This happened during the time of the Buddha. Monks started suiciding themselves. They were so repulsed by this. It's not them. It's not theirs. So let's get rid of it. So you have to do that with a teacher, because the teacher is going to help you get in balance with things. Now, I don't generally teach this kind of meditation, although I practiced it on my own. Well, I practice it with a teacher. It takes about 6 weeks or 6 months, and you really don't have much lust coming up after that. And that's the whole purpose of doing that. There's different kinds of personality types. A lust kind of personality type, they really are attached to their body and sensual pleasures and all of that. That's why this particular meditation was developed. And it was developed for new monks, so that they don't get caught up in lust and disrobe and get married and things like that. So, all of the meditations that the Buddha taught had very specific reasons for teaching in that way. Okay. Now, we're going to go to observation of feeling. Asubha?
Pardon?
Asubha?
Asubha.
Yeah. And how, monks, does a monk abide observing feeling as feeling? Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, a monk understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful feeling, he understands, I feel a painful feeling. When feeling a neither pleasant nor painful feeling, he understands, I feel neither a painful nor pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly pleasant feeling. And what is a worldly pleasant feeling? Chocolate. What's a worldly pleasant feeling?
One where you're experiencing a lot of money or gifts or things from the world.
No, not quite. No, not yet.
It's not awesome. It's the opposite.
No.
No.
A worldly pleasant feeling is a pleasant feeling at one of the sense doors. When? Huh? That's tongue sense door. Pleasant feeling. Okay, that's worldly. Only if it has some chocolate syrup on it, though. Now, when feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling. What's an unworldly pleasant feeling? That's right. It's the jhana. It's the wholesome mind that develops a very pleasant, unworldly.
So my permission is one of the worldly pleasures.
You're what? I didn't hear what you said at first. I just need the
mind formation.
A mind.
Your imagination.
Well, that's a worldly pleasant feeling. But the unworldly pleasant feeling is a jhana, because your mind is very pure. And that's why it's called unworldly, because it's not part of the six sense doors. When feeling a worldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly painful feeling. What is a worldly painful feeling? Huh?
The sense door.
Yeah. Right. It's a painful sensation at one of the sense doors. Okay, here we get tricky. When feeling an unworldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly painful feeling. What is an unworldly painful feeling? I've been talking about it for a long time. Meditation pain. You get up and you start moving around, that meditation pain disappears, right? He understands, or when a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling arises, he understands, I feel a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. What is it? A worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling?
And if I have a sense door that's neutral in its life and time?
No.
Oh.
Come on, Doug. Unworld or a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. No.
Is that delusion?
No.
No.
Indifference. Indifference has I don't care in it. Well, when feeling an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. What is that? Equanimity. Okay, you see how there's jhana in this section. Okay, now we go to observing mind and how monks, does a monk abide observing mind as mind? Here a monk understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust. And mind unaffected by lust is a mind unaffected by lust. He understands a mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate. And mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. He understands mind affected by delusion. What is delusion?
That, personal stuff.
Right. That is a deluded mind. It's seeing things and taking it personally And that's where a lot of suffering comes from. Now, the interesting thing with this particular set of three things, lust, hatred, delusion. I like it, I don't like it, I am that. Another way of describing? Craving. Okay, now we're going to get tricky again. He understands contracted mind as contracted mind. What is a contracted mind? No. Sloth and torpor. One of the ways that sloth and torpor is described in commentaries. It's like you have butter in the refrigerator and you have fresh out of the oven piece of bread. And you take that and you put it on the bread and you try to put it on. And that's what your mind is like, is that butter. It just contracted and hard. Okay.
I'm hungry.
Drink some water.
Could we talk about sloth and torpor? Because I was under the impression it meant laziness.
Sleepiness. And dullness.
How's that like the butter's off?
Because your mind is contracted, it's not pliable.
So when you're sleepy and dull, you should relax.
That's right. And I tell you to 6R and you go, but I'm already sleepy. Well, why don't you investigate how did it arise? What happened first? What happened after that? What happened after that? When you start investigating that way, you start picking up your energy. And when you pick up your energy, the sloth and torpor goes away. Well, it can go away fairly quickly. And I'm very familiar with sloth and torpor. Especially when I was only taking 2 hours sleep a night. I developed the ability to be asleep and be perfectly sitting. I don't know how useful that is, but
persistence.
Yeah.
Boy, that's one I'd love for you to just answer to.
When you have sloth and torpor, you have a tendency to have your back doing this, and before long your head is bobbing, right? And then you go, oh, I'm sleeping now, and you sit up real quick, and you say, I'm not going to let that happen again.
So the fighting, it makes it worse.
Trying to put too much energy at one time makes it worse. So when you have sloth and torpor, sit with your back a little bit straighter than is comfortable. And then, well, I'll tell you how it works. Okay, you can see it. You start by being on your object of meditation, but you have little tiny thoughts that start coming in, and you start paying attention to those instead of your object of meditation. And then your mind starts to have bigger thoughts. And then it starts to get dreamy, and then you start to slump, and then you start bobbing. Okay? So what I'm telling you to do is sit a little bit straighter, so if you get to that stage, you'll be able to see more clearly. Your mindfulness is sharper, that you see your back starting to slump and you can straighten up again. And you don't have to put near as much energy. See, the biggest problem with sloth and torpor is people try to make it go away. Try to push it. And they put you put too much energy in, and then that energy disappears, and then you have the same problem. So that doesn't work. Now, there's other ways of getting rid of sloth and torpor. The Buddha said that you get up and you wash your face. Doesn't work. For, at least for me, it never did. I can't say it doesn't work, but he also said if you reach up very slowly and you grab onto your earlobe and pinch as hard as you can overcome sloth and torpor. And that sometimes works. But when you sit straighter, then your mindfulness is, you're adding a little bit extra energy just to keep your mind a little bit straighter. So you're just using a little bit more energy, and you'll be able to be mindful when it starts slumping, and you'll be able to put that little bit of energy to sit up straight, and it won't last very long. I know a lady that did a 3-month retreat, and she sat in the front of the on a platform in front of a lot of people. For 3 months, her head was bobbing. Man, that's painful. No good. And then people would say, wow, you really had lousy meditation. Oh no, my meditation was great. It didn't bother me at all. You have a dull mind. Now, one of the precepts is not to take drugs or alcohol. Why? Because it dulls your mind. And it does affect you for a few days after you've already taken it. Your mind gets dull. And sitting in meditation just doesn't work so good. So keeping the precepts, there's a reason that the precepts are there. And the closer you follow this, the easier your meditation becomes, the more calm your mind becomes, the more tranquil your mind becomes. So it's a very necessary thing to keep the precepts. Yeah, but it's only a beer. It's only a glass of wine. I have a student that she decided to test. She was a very good meditator. She took a half a glass of wine, and it affected her meditation negatively for a full week. Her mind just dulled out. So if you want to do that to yourself, it's up to you. But it's really not recommended. Okay, let's get back to this. The distracted mind as distracted mind. He understands distracted mind as distracted mind. What is a distracted mind? Restless. So you have to learn how to adjust the energy that you're putting into watching your object of meditation. And adjust little tiny bits at a time. Try to adjust, back off a little bit, and then you still have the restlessness. Okay, then do it a little bit more. Don't try to do it all at once. It doesn't work. And not keeping your attention on the restlessness helps. Okay. He understands exalted mind as exalted mind. What is an exalted mind? That's right. In the Rupa Jhanas. He understands surpassed mind as surpassed mind. What is a surpassed mind? Arupa Jhanas. Why is it surpassed? No body. You're in a mental state. You've surpassed all of those lower jhanas. So again, we're talking about jhanas in the Satipatthana Sutta. Isn't that interesting? He understands a collected mind as collected. What's a collected mind? A mind that's in the jhanas. He understands liberated mind as liberated. What's a liberated mind? Nibbana. So this is pretty interesting because it's talking just about jhana. It's not talking about insights. Isn't that something? And that's where I'm going to stop for right now. Tomorrow I will do the mind objects because that's very important for you to understand. And then we'll do another sutta. But I've been talking for a real long time. Let's share some merit. May suffering ones be suffering free and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.